Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go over to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other things that are going on over there. Those things are podcast. You know you like podcasts. You're listening to one right now. Why wouldn't you listen to some of those, or at least check those out? Also, if you want to be one of the very last to get into Here We Still Stand, there's a handful of tickets left. You can go over to herewestillstand.org. You can register, and because you like listening to podcasts, you can use that promo code PNET19. Get $25 off your ticket. Man, if you're like a local Californian and you want to come hang out, bring it on. There's, just a few tickets left. If you're thinking about it, go ahead and jump on it. Also, Chad, I just wrapped up an Academy course, a 1517 Academy course. You know about the 1517 Academy because you did a course.
I did. Yeah. I did. I saw you had one coming out.
Yeah. So Chad did Christ in the Old Testament. And probably a bunch of you have taken that class. And if you haven't taken that class, you need to, and then you could still go take it. Now, I'm not as prolific as Chad, so I needed help. So I did a class along with Eric Sorensen. We tag team, first ever tag team class, and we did the life of Christ according to the Gospel of Luke. So not only did we not cover an entire Testament like Chad did, it took the two of us just to cover one book. But, we did our best. You can go pre-enroll right now. I'll put a link in the show notes, so you can, if you're listening to this online, scroll down and you'll see a link to the Academy class. Or if you're listening, in your podcast app or on iTunes, just go into your app and you will see it there in the show notes. You can click on that, or you can find it on the website or on Facebook or all those different places. You can pre-enroll. Those classes are going to begin soon. Another thing that's cool that we're doing is, in conjunction with the release of the class, in 30 Minutes in the New Testament, which is sort of the sister podcast to this that I do with Eric, we will begin going through the Gospel of Luke in conjunction with the class. And so obviously Luke will, the podcast will take us much longer, but the class will provide a great sort of overview of Luke, and then the podcast is sort of this deep dive if you want the verse-by-verse stuff. So go over, check it out. If you haven't taken Chad's class, register for both of them at the same time.
It'll be a good class. I'm looking forward to checking out the videos too. It's great to see 1570 putting these out. We had people all over the world taking my class. Going to be the same for yours. It's pretty cool when you can do this for free, and you get you enhance your biblical knowledge. And you get a better grasp exactly what the message of either Gospel of Luke or some element of theology or Christ in the Old Testament, whatever it is.
Yeah, it's good that you mentioned that they're free too. That's another thing. We throw things out there all the time, and then I get messages. People are like, "How much does this thing cost?" And I'm like, "Oh, well, unless it's like Here We Still Stand, it's probably free." That's how this works. So it's free because people support the work. So also, if you want to do that, there's a link for that too. If you want to kick back, pay it forward, we would love to have you join up and become a contributor as well.
I guess we're ready to jump back into Joshua. We covered chapter one last time, got a kind of overview of the whole book, and a good entry point into it, kind of the bridge between the end of Deuteronomy and Joshua. So we're gonna have an interesting narrative coming up today.
Yeah, hide the kids. Listening in the car. It's gonna get a little PG-13 in here today.
Yeah, we might need a rating on this one. Yeah, so the whole chapter, or at least the vast majority of the chapter, is about our friend named Rahab, or Rahav, if we were to say it in the Hebrew fashion. And there are a couple of different occurrences of the name Rahab where it's spelled exactly the same. I've had people ask me about this, so I want to clarify that right away. So in Joshua, when we're dealing with the individual named Rahab, it's spelled differently than the Rahab that you can read about, for instance, in the book of Isaiah. There's a sea monster whose name is Rahab too. And it's spelled, at least if you're not reading King James, I think King James spells the names differently. I had someone ask me about that. Like, is this the same name? No, it's actually not. There's two letters in Hebrew, both of which are like an H. One is like pretty much our English H, and one is kind of a rough H. So this is the rough H individual in Joshua 2. So it's really Rahav, which is sometimes spelled R-A-C-H-A-B. But we're used to pronouncing it Rahab, so we're just going to stick with that pronunciation. But just be aware that if you run across some sea monster in the book of Isaiah, whose name is Rahab, the sea monster was not named after the prostitute in Jericho. we're dealing with two different spellings. This is kind of an interesting story in lots of different ways. You know, one of the things that first struck me about this is just from a kind of a literary perspective, is that this story is fronted on the book of Joshua. I mean, I think that in itself is significant. That, well, not only that it was put at the front of the book of Joshua, but just that it was considered important enough to spend almost a whole chapter talking about, right? So yeah. you get kind of this introductory section, chapter one, okay, you know, Moses is dead, Joshua's taken over, and we're going to get all ready, you know, go through the tribes, tell them, all right, everything's about to happen. I know you've been waiting your whole life for this, but it actually is finally here, okay? So we get to that point, and it could have jumped ahead to saying they crossed the Jordan, you know, they kicked Jericho's butt, and they went on from there. But that's not the way that the author put this together. He spends 21 verses, which from a biblical perspective is a lot, talking about Rahab, which, as I say, from a literary perspective, not to mention the theological perspective, is significant. He shoves this story right up to the front of the book of Joshua.
I think it's interesting that the Bible as a whole does not shy away from stories about sinners, try to like gloss over like, well, all the sort of heroic things or good things were done by great, you know, great and righteous people. But man, there's a lot of prostitution in the Bible that it just doesn't shy away from. That's Old and New Testament. It's not just like a Jesus thing. I think we get that with Jesus. You know, we see the life of Christ and we're like, okay, everyone that's hanging out with him is, you know, he's got Gentiles and then he's got tax collectors and he's got adulterers and prostitutes and all this different kind of stuff, right? And of course, we know that the Pharisees are all upset about this. Well, one of the things that's surprising about them being so upset is God has sort of always had those people interspersed in the narrative. The Old Testament is full of non-Israelites and prostitutes. And there, I mean, if you read the book of Hosea, there's all this kind of stuff. You read the book of Ezekiel, it's like this. The idea that God sort of desires to bring those people in, that he desires to use them, to have a relationship with them, that should not be a foreign concept to the Pharisees and scribes whose job it is to study the Old Testament. This is one of the first examples of this, but it's certainly not the last.
Yeah, along those same lines, what's interesting is you do see, at least in some of the Jewish writings around the first century, a desire to whitewash some of these narratives. And I don't know if this was I did some reading on kind of the early Pharisaic or rabbinical treatment of Rahab. And then I also looked at the Jewish historian Josephus, who is late first century AD, and his treatment of Rahab as well. And there is a pronounced tendency to whitewash this story. So, for instance, that the Jewish historian Josephus in his book about the it's kind of a summary of the Old Testament, retelling of the Old Testament, the antiquities of the Jews. When he gets to the story of Rahab, there's no mention of her being a prostitute, which I find quite fascinating. Instead, he describes her as an innkeeper, so she basically has a hotel. she got a hotel Jericho. And a couple of these Israelite spies come in, and they need a place to crash, so they rent a room from her.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of the impression that you get of Rahab. I mean, I see that as Josephus was writing for Greeks. He wrote in Greek, and so he's writing for his Roman audience. And I think this was probably Josephus's way of trying to clean up the story a little bit, maybe to make it a little bit more palatable to the Romans when they read this, so they couldn't read this and be like, oh, gosh, you know, look at those Israelites getting saved by a prostitute. because, you know, it's scandalous, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, what's the best construction you can put on a brothel? I guess you can call it an inn. I mean, I suppose you could spend a night there, but it's not exactly what's going on. That sounds like going to the strip club and then telling your wife that you were at the bar.
Yeah, I just went out for drinks.
Yeah. I mean, technically true, but...
Technically true.
But omitting, like, a detail that everyone would be very interested in knowing about.
Yeah, pretty significant detail there.
We went to an inn, you know, a place where you can spend the night. It's an inn, right?
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, I mean, back to your original point, this is, as you say, this is just one example, but we have a whole lot of examples from the Old Testament. And we have talked about a bunch of those, if you've been with us this whole time, scattered throughout the Torah, but especially in the book of Genesis, numerous examples of people who went way astray and were brought back home by God. So, and then of course you're going to have just a multitude of examples after Joshua as well, where the same thing happens. So you can understand Jesus's, I guess, frustration with the scribes and the Pharisees who were so upset with him for hanging out with sinners and tax collectors, because he could say, hey, have you read your Bible? I mean, do you not realize what God has been doing all along in calling sinners to himself, in rescuing Rahabs and calling the Ninevites to repentance, and not just concerned with the people of Israel, but actually using the people of Israel to reach out in mercy to the Gentiles who were living around them. So there was the scribes and the Pharisees had absolutely no excuse for not realizing that the Messiah had come not just for the people of Israel, but indeed for those who were outside of the people of Israel, as well as those who were like technically Israelites, but who lived immoral lives or were considered unclean by the majority of Israel.
Yeah, I mean, a super good example of this is the woman of the city. You know, when Jesus is like hanging out at a dinner party with a Pharisee, and then a well-known prostitute comes walking in the door, and you can just tell, like, this guy is just completely horrified.
Yeah.
He's not like, oh, good, like, the sinners are repenting. He's like, all right, if this dude was really of God, he would know who this is, and he would not even let her touch him.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fairly big indictment on the exegetical skill of the Pharisee.
Yeah, it is an indictment of that. And unfortunately, it seemed to be pretty widespread, at least in the rabbinic writings that I looked at. So, I mean, she's called a Gentile. She's understood to be a non-Israelite who was brought into the family of Israel. But there's a lot of cleaning up of her story that's done in some of the rabbinical writings, which would have reflected, which actually were part of the Pharisaic tradition. So anyway, I guess all of that is kind of an intro to this story. And why don't we jump into it?
Let's do
it.
Because
there's a lot of very rich details that were given in the story as well. So this is like, you know, same song, second verse kind of deal, because Israel is at the edge of the promised land, as they have been before. Israel is sending spies in, as they have before. So this is a lot like Numbers chapter 13. We've been here before. We've been on the brink of the promised land. We have seen spies go in. We've seen spies return with a report about the land. So this is like, okay, what's going to happen this time? It's kind of that sort of situation. So we'll see what happens this time. Joshua sends two guys in as spies secretly from Shittim, which is where they're camped, saying, go view the land, especially Jericho. So they went and came into the house of a prostitute whose name was Rahab and lodged there. I'm just going to read the first few verses. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, behold, men from the sons of Israel have come here tonight to search out the land. And the king of Jericho sent word to Rahab, saying, bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the land. But the woman had taken the two men and hidden them. And she said, Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And it came about when it was time to shut the gate at dark that the men went out. And I don't know where the men went. Pursue them quickly, for they will over, for you will overtake them. But she had brought them up to the roof and hid them in the stalks of flax, which she had laid in order on the roof. So the men pursued them on the road to the Jordan, to the fords. And as soon as those who were pursuing them had gone out, they shut the gate. So we'll stop there. We'll stop there for a minute. Man, I'm not even really sure where to start. There's so much here, but I guess one of the things that jumped out at me when I was looking at this, just in the Hebrew itself, there's that word, that adverb secretly at the very opening. Joshua the son of Nun sent two men as spies secretly from Shittim. Now that adverb can modify different things here. So were the spies just supposed to go secretly? That seems kind of repetitive, right? Aren't spies supposed to be secret? I mean, is there such a thing as a non-secret spy?
an open spy?
Yeah, an open spy. That's not really so the secretly part can't be really talking about the spies. I think I'm not 100% sure of this, but I think what's going on here is, okay, Joshua has actually been in this situation before. Remember that Joshua and Caleb were the two spies when they were much younger who were sent in by Moses among, you know, there were 12 of them, but Joshua and Caleb were two of them. And Joshua remembers what happened last time. So, you know, very publicly, 12 guys were sent into the promised land to spy it out and return it with a report. And that didn't go very well. Came back and 10 of them were like, no, we're going to get tramped. We're just going to get killed, slaughtered by these people. They're huge. We're like grasshoppers compared to them. So that ended very poorly. So I'm thinking maybe what Joshua, where Joshua is now, he's like, you know what? I'm going to send a couple of guys, but I'm not going to tell anybody else. So I'm going to send the spies out, but I'm going to send them secretly. And I'm going to have them report back to me and tell me what happened. I'm not going to make this a whole public spectacle like Moses did. So, and I, like I say, I'm not 100% sure that's what's going on here, but I suspect that is what's happening.
No, I mean, this is just learning from a previous situation where you're like, yeah, I don't really need these guys coming back, giving a certain report, and then having the entirety of the nation freaking out.
Yeah, spending 40 more years walking around in the wilderness.
Yeah, this seems very much more like Joshua personally wants to know as sort of the military leader here.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, that's what happens. We read at the end of the chapter that when the two guys do come back, they go to, it doesn't say they went to Israel or to the people of Israel. They came to Joshua and related to him everything that had happened. So this seems to be kind of a very secretive sort of operation. Joshua says, hey, here's what I want you to do. Find out everything you can about, especially about Jericho, and come back and report only to me what you find. Well, which is what they do. And I just have to laugh because the first place these guys go is to the home of a prostitute. I mean, really? It's like there's no record of them going anywhere else. It's like, okay, we're going to go into Jericho. Where should we go first? Well, there's the home of a prostitute. Let's go there. So that's where they end up. I mean, we're not told they went to, they first went and got some coffee at the Jericho Starbucks, hung out there for a while, and then walked around. They just go right to the home of a prostitute.
Yeah,
maybe that's where you got news. Maybe that's where everybody related the news.
I guess it is a weird story because you would assume that they weren't supposed to go into any houses. This is not very spy like. Like you're supposed to be like creeping around, just checking things out.
Right.
How'd you end up in this house in the first place?
I got a couple of ideas.
There's really just two options. One, you were like pretty sure that's a brothel. So we can go in there. That's fine. They don't care. They're not going to think anything of it. Or two, you know, I don't know, someone saw you and you were getting pursued and that's the house you ran into. I mean, those are like the only options.
Yeah, yeah.
But it doesn't say that they were being pursued. The only reason you might think that is that people came to that house and said, yo, where's those guys at? But this, yeah, but this also seems more likely that they went in there and there were other people that had left there that then reported and said, hey, there's some guys in there and they're not from here.
Right, yeah. Got some strangers in town. They're in the brothel, so they go report to the king, and then everything happens after that.
There's some guys in town. They might belong to that, I don't know, millions of guys that are outside the camp.
Yeah, right, right. So whatever the motivation, this is where they end up, is in the house of Rahab. So and as we were just saying, the king of Jericho finds out that these spies have come in. And so he sends word to Rahab. Now Rahab right away comes across as a pretty smart lady. I mean, when you look at how she deals with a situation, and actually, you know, what she comes across as a smart lady, but also is extremely courageous. I mean, her life is on the line. When the guys come from the king and she says what she says, I don't know. I mean, I didn't know who these guys were. You know, they were here and they did their thing and they left. So, hey, it wasn't that long ago. Why don't you take off after them? You can catch them, you know? So she's smart, but she's also courageous because if they had searched her home and found these guys, she'd be dead. I mean, she basically has committed treason against the king. So she's putting her own life on the line and she's pretty smart. I mean, she's quick on her feet. She has an answer immediately for the guys that come to her door looking for the spies. So she comes across right away as someone who is going to exercise not only bravery and intelligence, but as we're going to find out in a minute, also she's articulate and she's wised up to the situation that she is now in, and actually is going to, as we'll see in just a minute, is going to give a beautiful confession of faith in the God of Israel. So let's go on. We'll get to that now. So picking up here at verse 8, now before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof. Roofs were typically flat at that time, so they're on this flat roof. And she says to the men, I know. So this is the beginning of her confession. It's going on for about four or five verses. I know that the Lord, and she uses the divine name here, Yahweh. I know that Yahweh has given you the land and that the terror of you has fallen on us and that all the inhabitants of the land have melted away before you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea before you when you came out of Egypt and what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And when we heard it, our hearts melted, and no courage remained in any man any longer because of you. For the Lord, your God, she uses the divine name there again, for Yahweh, your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now, therefore, please swear to me by the Lord, since I have dealt kindly with you, that you will also deal kindly with my father's household, and give me a pledge of truth, and spare my father and my mother and my brothers and my sisters with all who belong to them, and deliver our lives from death. So we'll stop there for a minute. It's a pretty amazing confession.
Well, it's a pretty great confession, and you also figure out exactly the motivation behind that bravery. You also figure out that this is also how you know that the inhabitants of this land absolutely know about Israel, and they not only that, but they're terrified of what they believe is coming. I mean, she says that everyone's freaked out about it, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone's heard, everyone's courage has melted away, everyone's freaked out, and then she's confronted with these guys, and she decides that instead of, oh, here's some spies, I better tell someone because the war is upon us. She's like, you know what? This is a great opportunity for me to get on what I think is the winning side of this based on what I've heard.
Right. Yeah. She knows exactly which is going to be the winning team here. It's mind-blowing to me to think about how the word spread.
Yeah.
I mean, she's living in a city in Jericho, and you know, I don't know how many miles away from Egypt that is, but it's a long way. But you know, word has begun to spread. You have people traveling, you have traders, you have soldiers moving about here and there. And what happened? And remember, this happened 40 years ago. But what happened, what God did to Egypt at the Red Sea for the Israelites, that became not just the talk of the town or even the talk of the region, but the talk of many lands. So word about what God did at the Red Sea had spread, become one of these just well-known divine acts that circulated among various peoples at that time. And not only that, but in a little bit closer time frame, she'd also heard about what happened when they had to deal with Og and the other giants and armies that they had to face, such as Sihon. So word of the defeat of the Israelites over the victory of the Israelites over them had spread as well. So this is actually in fulfillment. Everything that's happening, everything that Rahab says, and everything she describes is happening, like the hearts of the Canaanites melting away before Israel, is actually in fulfillment of what Israel actually sang, or what Moses taught them to sing at the Red Sea. Let me read you a couple of verses from way back in Exodus. This is the Shirat HaYam, that's the Song of the Sea. And this is what they sing right after they cross through the sea. Let me pick up here at, where is it at? Okay, I'm picking up here with Exodus 15:14. The peoples have heard, they tremble. Anguish has seized the inhabitants of Philistia. Then the chiefs of Edom were dismayed. The leaders of Moab, trembling grips them. And then here's the key phrase. All the inhabitants of Canaan have melted away. Terror and dread fall upon them. So they sang this song way back at the crossing of the Red Sea. And not only did it describe what had happened then, it also became prophetic of what was going to happen in the future. So that same language that's used in Exodus 15 about the hearts of the Canaanites melting away and terror and fear gripping them, that's precisely what Rahab is echoing in her words to the spies in Joshua 2. So we see how there's this interplay between earlier words in the Torah and now what's happening in the book of Joshua, where that which was prophesied is actually coming to pass now. And the fact that she uses the divine name, I think, is also significant. She doesn't say, you know, we've heard what the God of Israel did to the Egyptians and to Og and to all these other people. But she actually uses the divine name. She knows, in other words, the God of which she speaks. He's not just one God in a vast pantheon or one God among a lot of different options. In fact, she says, not only do we know what Yahweh did, but near the very end of her speech, she says, for the Lord, that is Yahweh, your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. So we have this confession of faith on the part of Rahab that the God of the Israelites is the one true God, not just in heaven above, but on earth beneath as well.
Yeah, I think some of this makes sense. I mean, if there's this group of people who have like escaped Egypt, which is crazy. Just crazy in general, not to mention the crazy way in which they escaped Egypt, but just the fact that they were able to do it period at all is crazy. Then you're like, oh, what? Hey, what happened to old Sion and Og? Oh, that's the same group of people that like passed through the Red Sea. Like, they totally wiped them out. And then you say, like, who are these people? Like, and a question that you would ask certainly in that time period that you wouldn't ask now, but then you would ask, like, who's their God?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
You would absolutely ask this. And then they'd be like, oh, well, their God is Yahweh. So it makes sense that name would be floated around. And it also makes sense that if you had heard rumors of this whole thing, you're like, well, what is this God like? Oh, he's, you know, you'd hear all kinds of crazy stuff. And maybe you'd have to figure out, like, that can't be true. But even if you just heard the truth, you'd be like, This God like brings bread down from heaven. He like he appears as like a pillar of cloud and like a pillar of fire. So that's all heaven stuff. He parts the Red Sea. He makes water come out of rocks. He wins battles for you. This is all like heaven and earth kind of stuff. It makes sense that if you end up believing all this, and there's lots of reasons to believe it, because I mean, cities have been wiped out at this point. You're like, yeah, this God's legit. He's a God of heaven and of earth. And if this is all true, like, we're in real trouble here. If he has actually promised to give them this land, I would prefer to be a worshiper of this God as opposed to a worshiper of whatever other gods these people were worshiping.
Yeah, yeah. It's a wonder that Rahab and her family are the only ones in the whole city of Jericho who actually
thought about converting.
Believed. Yeah, thought about converting. You know, we're gonna and this Rahab isn't the only one. We're gonna come just in just a few chapters, we're gonna come across a whole group of people who fake the Israelites into thinking that they're from like a way distant country when they actually like live right there in the land. But I mean, they've wised up too. They're just like Rahab. They've heard everything that's happening. They're like, yeah, we need to make peace treaty with these people, or we're dead. So they did the same thing. So word is spreading, and you can see then we've talked about this several different times that God was concerned, and well, not just God, but Moses was concerned about God's reputation. Right? He said, "I don't want you to wipe out all these people because, you know, what's going to happen when other peoples hear of what you did? Then your name is going to lose all power, all significance. Your reputation is going to suffer because of this." So Moses was right. You know, the word about Yahweh, the reputation of Yahweh was spreading, and it was having an impact, both positive as well as negative, on those who heard what kind of God he was. Okay, so let's see what happens. After she says this, they make a deal, basically. The spies say, okay, what? Here's what's going to happen. And we're going to put our life on the line for you because you have put your life on the line for us. So if you don't tell anybody about what we've done, then here's what we'll do for you when we attack the city. So I want you to put this, it's called a cord of scarlet thread in the window. So that's going to be like the neon sign on your house for all the Israelite warriors to see. That's going to say, don't enter this house. Don't attack this house. Everybody who's inside this house is to be spared. So she's supposed to get her mom and her dad and her siblings and everybody that's kind of part of her extended family. You know, they didn't think in terms of like nuclear families back there. They, you know, there was a wider family. Everybody was supposed to come into the one house, close the doors, put this scarlet cord on the outside, and wait until the city was taken before anybody left the house. So if you do that, the spies say, then you're going to be okay. No harm is going to befall you. And if any harm does befall anybody in your family, then we're going to shed our own blood as a result of that. So they are putting their own life on the line. So they basically make this deal. And she says, all right, according to your words, so be it. And she lets them down through the window and they sneak away and go hide. They like go the opposite direction of what the pursuers would have gone. They hide out for 3 days in the hill country before they go back to Joshua. So there's a couple of details here that I think are worth focusing on just for a minute in the time that we have left. One is this image of the cord of scarlet thread that's in the window. You might not realize that we've actually seen this word scarlet many, many times. Shani is the Hebrew word there, and it's used multiple times, especially in the book of Exodus and Leviticus, to describe the one of the many colors that is dyed into the fabrics of the tabernacle and the curtains in the tabernacle and even the vestments that are worn by the high priest. So this was a dye that was evidently often used in the ancient world to mark things, you know, whether it's just regular clothing or sacred tents or sacred clothing. So this becomes a marker for the attackers, for the Israelite soldiers. When they see this, they know that this is the house that is to be spared. And one more little Hebrew tidbit here that I didn't know about until this morning. I just came upon it. The word for cord that's used there, this cord of scarlet thread, is the Hebrew word is tikvah. But this is the only place in the Old Testament where tikvah, which is translated here as cord, is translated that way. Everywhere else, it means hope. It's kind of interesting there. So it could be that it's actually two different words that are spelled the same, but have different meanings. Or it could be that this one word, tikvah, has actually two different meanings that are some way joined together. Whatever's going on, whatever actually like linguistically is happening there with that word, there's no doubt in my own mind anyway that his choice of using that word is an indication of kind of an underlying meaning, that because this cord is also the hope that Rahab has. This is going to be the hope of her redemption, the hope of her family's being spared when the city's attacked. So this kind of interesting thing that, of course, you can't see in the English translation, but that's kind of going on in the Hebrew, where tikvah means both cord as well as hope.
Yeah, there's this pretty awesome tie-in too, just visually, of, you know, as the angel of the Lord moves through Egypt, the children of Israel are spared as they have, you know, the blood of a lamb over the door, and you will see this happen where there is scarlet marking this house for the Israelites to pass over. Passing over the scarlet marked house is not a foreign thought to the Israelites. I mean, they weren't, the Israelites now that are present there weren't there for that, but they know about it.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking that too. There's kind of a Passover theme that you have, because this is, you have an upcoming destruction and you have many people being killed, but some being spared. Well, how are they spared? Well, it's because they're behind locked doors. They're not supposed to go out. And as you say, they're marked both by something that's scarlet color, whether it's a cord or whether it's the blood of the Passover lamb. So you can see, I think this is a great example of what I like to call the layering of scripture, where you have this kind of foundational, in this particular case, you have this foundational Passover imagery, and then layered on top of that, now you have what's happening in Joshua. And you're going to have more of this as the scriptures go on. But this is how later scriptures will co-opt the language and imagery of earlier stories and adapt it to a new context, with the understanding that when you read, for instance, Joshua 2, you're going to read that with one ear listening also to Exodus chapter 12, the story of the Passover. So this just one example among literally thousands of examples in the scriptures where you have this kind of interplay between a couple of different narratives.
Yeah. And that's it, man. That is chapter 2, and that is 40 minutes. So, hey, man, we're doing one chapter an episode right now. We'll see.
We're doing good. Yeah.
See how
we got the
continues.
Crossing of the Jordan coming up next. It'll be good.
Yeah, man. It's good to be back in narrative, guys. If the podcast has been helpful to you and you'd like to become a contributor and help us out, you can go over to 1517, go to the donate page, and you can do that. Thank you so much to those of you who do contribute. If you want to sign up for the Academy class with Eric and myself, you can do that. The link is in the show notes. Also, while you're over there, if you haven't taken Chad's class in the Old Testament, we know you like the Old Testament because you're listening to this podcast, so you should definitely do that as well. And Chad, I will see you next week.
All right, man. We'll see you then.